Well, what did you learn or get out of your connection with Catholic University? Can you explain that program that you were getting into?
What I learned out of it was it deepened my faith, and it taught me the vanity of planning. Because I came up here, signed the lease, and went there, and then the funding for the center never materialized. And I was now in financial trouble because I had budgeted and planned everything that a check would start coming August. And when it didn't, in this city, the meter runs very fast. And so I had to go look door to door. I never did any work with the center. All I did was a little, me and another person basically renovated what was going to be our office, painting it, scraping up old carpet, fixing the toilets, decobwebbing it. It was an abandoned house off the campus of Catholic University. But I never officially worked a day for the center because the money never came in, and I was broke. And by September, I had to go door to door looking for a job. Mm-hmm.
What was the promise of the Peace Center? What kind of work were you expecting to get into?
It was to focus on John Paul II's statement, to reach peace, you must teach peace, which impressed me, that there had to be an understanding of how to live peacefully with people. But again, I must say, I wasn't all that set on the work as much as this was an alternative to practicing law. It was going to be in Washington. It was interesting. But I didn't have any great vision of the work or even knew what I was going to do. It was completely incipient project. And we never really got past that stage because the money never came in, so we never really started sitting down and saying, all right, what do we want to do? They were calling it the Center for International Catholic Studies. But it never existed.
Oh, really? While I was there. None of it got off the ground.
Never. Uh-huh. Never. And so it was an idea, and in retrospect, I look at it as God's will of bringing me to Washington. And there would have been no other way I would have come up here other than it wasn't a law job, and it was Father Kerr who brought me up here. I trusted him and came, and I have no bitterness for him. I see it clearly as the will of God. But those were three difficult months.
So what did you do to get out of that fix?
To make a little money, I clerked with one law firm to do one appeal for a person, a criminal appeal, wrote in a brief. And then I was just going door to door papering this town with my resume. And having sold books door to door, I was now trying to sell me door to door. And it was far more difficult because you take rejection more personally, it becomes more frustrating. You have people interviewing you that you feel you're more qualified for their job than they are. People putting their, I remember this one guy, this cigar, this feet in my face while he interviewed. So it was, I look back on it now as a great blessing, and it has given me an empathy for people unemployed in the city looking for work, because it's tough and you can get discouraged real quickly. But after going door to door for some time, then in November of 81, I got a 2-week job with Senator Childs to write a little flyer on the budget for him. That then was extended on, and then that became permanent employment with them within the first month and a half. I think it worked out. They liked me. But that was a real awakening for me to work on the Hill. I knew nothing about politics. If someone said, hey, there's Senator so-and-so, I could have cared less. If they'd said, there's Bobby Knight, or there's some athlete, well, then I would have, I would have been interested. But I couldn't have named 3 U.S. senators. And I certainly knew nothing about how the government ran or anything. So it was, I went there because I knew my law degree from Florida State wouldn't exactly swing open doors in Washington. I had signed a lease here. I said, I got to stay. So I said, well, the Hill, people told me there was turnover on the Hill. So I figured, well, I'll go work on the Hill, I guess.
And how directly did that lead to finally, your involvement with Hatfield?
Well, that's another great hidden mystery of all this. While I was going door to door, I befriended a woman, a very kind woman, who was trying to help me. She was a receptionist. There was no opening in her office, But she was going to now look for me. She worked for a Florida congressman. And I was blanketing the Florida delegation because that was obviously all of my ties. And we became friends. And I saw on her desk a picture of a Indian child. And she was white. And I said, is that one of Mother Teresa's children? Because I had read that Mother Teresa had an orphanage and so forth. Yes, it was. Well, we became very fast friends because I had read a book on Mother Teresa that had been given to me by Malcolm Muggeridge. And I was just casually interested in Mother Teresa's life, but it was a conversation piece, and there was this child. Well, that woman and that friendship that was started led to meeting her husband, Randy Stearns.
And her name was?
Her name was Janet Stearns. And Randy, at that time, was one of the most respected staff members of Senator Hatfield's office. A very quiet guy. He was a lawyer. He did his tax, senator's tax work. So he was humble to a fault, which is why he hadn't, you know, climbed the staircase so much. He just kept himself. He was an Oral Roberts graduate. She was the Assembly of God church members, and here I was. So there was another one of these contrasts, but we became very good friends. In fact, I talked to her all the time. And her next daughter that they adopted from mother, I went to the airport to meet, and Anjali Stearns is one of the most special people in my life, period. So that it's funny how starting with Childs and the process to look for a job was what led me to meet Janet, which led me to Randy, which got my foot in the door, because Senator Hatfield's office, when I started going door to door, I learned about this Senator Hatfield, who was a Christian man, and that was important to me, that this man was really believed in God and felt that that's something that should impact his public service. But I immediately went to their office, and I couldn't get past the front door. I handed the resume, I said, I'm sorry. The receptionist was named Gail. At that time, she wasn't married to Jim Hemphill. She is now. She's very friendly, but sorry, can't help you. So that was that. And I was working with Childs, but then I'd have lunches with Randy and all, and he knew I wasn't happy in Senator Childs' office. Senator Childs himself was a lovely man, but the staff and the intrigue and the infighting was more than I could take. It wasn't so much personal to them as it was just a rabid adjustment for me. Mm-hmm. It was just a very difficult transition from basketball to politics and into this office setting where everyone was closed conscious and was, conscious of what your status was. If you were really a high staffer, and there was this intrigue about how to get in, and it was just all so petty and frustrating.
I am thinking about your remarks about going door to door and encountering their an impression of Hatfield or the reputation of Hatfield. Could you be more specific in exactly what form this was in when you encountered these people going door to door to offices around the Hill? Is that right?
Yeah,
did this come up?
I also, Janet told me a lot about it. When I was going door to door, she told me about Senator Hatfield and Randy. She gave me one of his books, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, which I read, and I was very impressed with, very impressed with. So then I sought an interview, and I think she got me in to see the executive assistant, Jim Hemphill, to see him. But he was, sorry, we don't have any jobs. We'll keep the same standard line you hear from every office. So I would say that a lot of my interest in Senator Hatfield came from Janet and Randy's experience with him. That was at the earliest stage of my job search. But then once I started working in the Senate, I was very interested in him, and whenever he would be on television. I can remember one time in the gallery, and it may have been before I got a job, I just happened to be over in the Senate. No, I was working for Childs, and I went over to the floor, and Senator Hatfield was down there on the floor managing an appropriations bill. And I didn't know who it was while I heard him talking, and I was really impressed with him. And then I saw someone say the senator from Oregon, and I went, oh, I wonder if that's Senator Hatfield. And that was the first time I ever saw him. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing, again, is why I believe this is a great grace from God, was that I was becoming increasingly disenchanted with working in Senator Childs's office and in Washington in general, and was contemplating moving back to Florida when I got a call from Janet saying there's an opening in Hatfield's office, and call up Randy and maybe you can come over and see Mr. Frank. Mm-hmm. And that happened.
What was his first opening?
Jeff Booth was moving from the personal staff to committee staff, and they needed a legislative assistant. And I had understood from Janet and Randy that this wasn't one where there was a clear in-house person they were going to put there, so that they were open to looking at other people. And Randy had such high credibility in Mr. Frank's eyes that a recommendation by Randy, but you ought to talk with him, was just as good as gold. Mm-hmm. That was really a big help. Mm-hmm. And Randy was such a kind guy that gave me a real boost. Mm-hmm. I had met Mr. Frank way back when, just as a courtesy thing to try to, again, to get over into the Hatfield office, because I kept hearing Randy describe how nice things were in their office and how things got along, and I'd tell him stories about my office, and he'd be just stunned. Mm-hmm. But Mr. Frank met me for a total of 1 minute. It was a most brief encounter, and I was like, yeah, that's a busy man. But anyway, this second time when I went in for an interview with him, well, then within a matter of, I think it was that same week, it was done. I didn't even hesitate a second. In fact, Senator Childs's office then, when they realized I was about to go, offered all this money, better position, and I just said, no. I said to Senator Childs, Senator, I really believe this God's asking me to take this job, and I prayed over it, and I believe that. Mm-hmm. And Senator Childs said, well, you have to listen to that little voice inside of you. It's God, and you go with my blessing, and we hugged, mm-hmm. which was incredible. I'd only worked for him for 6 months. It was the most incredible encounter. But there was still a lot of resentment in Childs's office about jumping, and I was sensitive to it. I'd only been there 6 months, but there was just no doubt in my mind I wanted to work there. I didn't even care what I'd do in Senator Hatfield's office. I just wanted to go. Mm-hmm.
Oh, they didn't. They resented your moving to a different office,
uh-huh.
even though you'd only been there a short time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Especially when they made an attempt to keep me there. Mm-hmm.
Well, and how long was it before you got to meet the senator?
I met him. I'll never forget this, too. I was interviewing with Jerry Frank a second time, and this was at the point where the decision had been made to hire me. And Jerry had me in the senator's office in the Russell Building in his private area, and we were talking back and forth. And then the senator came in through the hallway door, not knowing we were in there. And he walked in there and said, oh, excuse me. And then Mr. Frank said, Senator, I'd like you to meet Jim Toohey, the guy I told you about that's going to be coming on board with us. Whether he ever told the senator or not, who knows, you know. Mm-hmm. The senator said, oh, nice to meet you, nice to meet you. And he said, why don't you visit for a second? Mm-hmm. And so Jerry left the room. So as the senator was asking me questions, he said, well, I read your writing sample. I guess he must have known about me because he said he had read the speech I had written for Senator Childs, and he was impressed and asked some questions. And then I said something about, well, this was a blessing from God. And he says, oh, you have a faith in Christ. I said, oh, yes, sir. He goes, well, this adds a whole new dimension. I didn't know that. And I remember that language. He said, well, this adds a whole new dimension to our relationship. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know that. Well, what a blessing from, or something. I don't remember the rest of it, except that he had said, well, this adds a whole new dimension. I didn't even know that. And so that was kind of funny. When he found out my tradition was Catholic, he didn't say anything at that time. I think I mentioned at that time. And he just went, well, that's great. And he found it kind of interesting.
I feel that I have missed something. Now I see you speaking as though you had formed a really definite sense of mission, or not mission, but of guidance and so forth. Is there something in your development that brought you very much closer to this sense of following a course that somehow God approved?
Of Washington?
Of in your life, of somehow a sense of religious purpose in what you were doing.
I think that gradually, over the same period of time, and I kept journals and things over for the last 10 or 12 years, that there was a growing spirituality that was just kind of picking up speed like a train. That more and more, I did feel a special relationship to God. I mean, I'd always prayed the rosary with our Blessed Mother, but it was had gone from something that was contained to the monastic tradition, which impressed me so much, which said that when you were working in the bakery or when you were working in the field, that was prayer. That was a novel concept to me, that could be prayer. And I was handed a book in Washington early on by Brother Lawrence, written in the 14th century. He was a monk, which was called The Practice of the Presence of God. And it was this notion of integrating what you do with your prayer life. And it was a very important book to me, a very simple book. This guy was a simple guy. And so more and more, even though I was going to Mass in the mornings and was seeking more, I got involved with an orphanage late in Florida. And then when I got up here, just to find something, when I first got a job with Childs, I started working with the Higher Achievement Program, tutoring these inner city kids. But again, the sense was giving back to God something. I had a feeling really soon after I started working with Senator Hatfield, within the first month, I think, that, yes, now I understand why I'm in Washington. Mm-hmm. And it really was a kind of an epiphany, mm-hmm. that up until that point, it was all so confused, and I was kind of, but then all of a sudden, I had to realize, because the job made sense. I felt there was a purpose. Senator Hatfield's spirituality was very impressive to me. That this notion of you serve God was something I'd gotten from the monastery, from my desire for more and more prayer, and then also from seeing Senator Hatfield in action. Mm-hmm. So that it was really a lovely integration of work with what had already been growing in me, which was a growing sense. I mean, I had been praying very hard over the question of the priesthood. And I was wondering whether my tough time in Washington was God's way of saying, enter the seminary. Mm-hmm. I had wrestled with that all through law school. And when I got to Washington, it was still a very relevant question to me. It still is. Mm-hmm. But when I started working with Senator Hatfield, I thought, well, Lord, this is something. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers your question, but
yeah,
there wasn't a purpose. There wasn't a point where I felt, aha, now life makes sense. It was more of, well, number one, I was taught the vanity of planning. There's no point in trying to plan all these things out because they can fall apart like it just did. Number two, I was taught trust in God because I was going door to door. I would get at one place, Congressman Bennett's office, and say, oh, we just hired somebody yesterday that fit exactly what you, and we would have hired you, and all these, just on and on, where I just felt like I was getting bounced around, and other things happened. I'd broken up with a girl I dated 6 years throughout school, so that there was a confluence of factors which led me more and more to say, look, the only thing I can trust on is God, is trusting God. And I, as a way of self-preservation, mm-hmm. that relying on these and this and this, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It all is so fragile, it all hangs by a thread. Mm-hmm. So I felt, and then when I was in Childs's office, I didn't know, but spirituality was clearly very big in me, and maybe I was heading very close to the priesthood because I was disenchanted with Childs, and I was very interested in the monastery. I'd gone back other times. And I liked time alone, and so. Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to ask you kind of a two-level thing. If you could describe describe the work that you got into. And then while you were getting into this work, perhaps bring into it what you were seeing about the how the staff worked, fitted in with the senator. It's a very large idea, but why don't we get into that?
Sure. The issues I was assigned were, it was quite a potpourri of things. There was all of his Judiciary Committee things, immigration, the death penalty, gun control. There was labor-ish issues. There were labor issues, you know, minimum wage. And I had Social Security. I had railroad retirement. Half of this stuff I knew nothing about. There was Indians. Those were my major responsibilities, to be a legislative assistant in those areas. None of those were issues that he was particularly identified with as a leading advocate. It was mostly mail management and keeping him up to date on the information so that his position was always a conscienced position. Mm-hmm. Someone had told me early on, and it really was true, that with Senator Hatfield, the issue was conscience. That there was a sense of right and wrong in every single issue, and that if he was undecided on something, look at where the rights and wrongs stood, or as you felt they stood, and argue that. Mm-hmm. And that would always help. And so, for example, on the death penalty or some of these things, he had already had a very strong position. But on other areas, like refugees, he had very little identification with that issue. But to me, it was a right and wrong issue, and he was immediately interested. Mm-hmm. But I was doing mostly mail. I followed my own counsel, which was stay out of his contact. Don't bother him unless it's important. Send memos in and out on questions and answer things, but only go into there to see him when it is important. I did that. I basically was seen and not heard. But I started June 1st, 1982 with him. But within that first month, one of the issues in my area was the big filibuster, the Voting Rights Act. And it was my area, and I had to work up a floor statement. So I was thrown quickly into the fast lane. I was down on the Senate floor with him all of a sudden. I couldn't believe that during the debate sitting there. I was in the senator's hideaway with him and his friend at 11:30 while a filibuster was going on. His friend Gene Arnold was having a banana split. I was just kind of numb by all of this, that I all of a sudden had gone from such an unsatisfactory situation to such a, it was so stimulating, and he was so gracious. And it was also new, that it was really, I was just in heaven. And the staff was so kind. Mr. Frank would call me up and say, well, after that night, he called me the next day, well, the senator said you did an extraordinary job on the Voting Rights Act. And Tom Getman, the legislative director, would encourage me, saying great work. The people were so nice. It was quiet in the office. People's desks were all clean, and this was kind of all weird for me. Everything I just said was in stark contrast to what I'd experienced before. There was a sense of people getting along, and that it wouldn't be acceptable conduct to yell in an office at somebody. Or to trample on someone in some way. And this was a mood that was set right at the top and at every level down. And so.
Has that had any effect on anyone else's office that you know of?
Senator Hatfield's?
As a model?
Well, you know, Jim Hempel and Jerry will tell you that they're approached all the time by offices wanting to see how our office works. I mean, the mechanics of the office, it's a pretty well-oiled machine. But I don't get into that so much. I don't know. In fact, I've been kind of a rebel, a controlled rebel in the office on some of the things we've done with computers and with the modular stuff. I mean, some of it I've kind of opposed. I didn't like the idea, for example, of a two-floor office, and had protested against it. I felt it wasn't right. I was upstairs at the time, But I still feel it's not preferable, that there's a barrier there. Because we had in Russell Building just a one-floor office, and everyone was on equal footing, as it were. Mm-hmm. Some people had bigger office space than others, and theirs was an area where Jerry and the ledge director sat, and there was an area where we sat, and there was an area, you know, so it wasn't like, but there was just something to me about that and the computers and things. But, you know, they've been very open to complaints, too.
I don't understand the two-tier thing. How does that actually work to separate things?
Well, by having the stairwell, and then by having, it was also exacerbated by the fact they were issuing badges at that time that had different colors, Senate badges, that had different colors. And the different colors were going to determine your access to the Senate floor and to areas in the Capitol. And a decision was made to issue those badges to the downstairs people, but that included two personal secretaries who never ever went over to the floor. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of ludicrous, but that's how they did it because they only had a limited number. But this was after we had moved into the two-floor setting, into the Hart Building over in 322. And I had just felt that we enjoyed so much that, but a stairwell is a barrier. It's, we've got to go upstairs, got to go downstairs. There was never, if the senator was talking with Jerry or was in the office, you kind of always knew when you were in this closed area. But now, there's going to be this upstairs, downstairs. You couldn't just kind of look up and see if someone was down the area. You didn't have just 10 feet. You now had upstairs, you know. So these things were, and I felt it might hurt the unity of the office. But whether it has or it hasn't, I'm too close to it now to know.
Yeah. Were there some do's and don'ts that were communicated to you? And I guess I should also ask, who is the person who was sort of more a guide to you than others?
The do's and don'ts were never articulated except that there was a 48-hour rule on mail. That was inviolable, and that was serious business in the office. You had to get the mail turned around in 48 hours. Jerry also, in the interview, asked me if I was a clean desk operator. And I said, yes, I wasn't. I could be. I mean, I think I didn't say, yes, I am. I said, I will be a clean desk operator, and he liked that. I mean, Jerry, clearly that was another do. That was in the interview, and I learned it, and I'm very happy that way to keep it from just piling up, because you end up working on whatever level you're at anyhow. Randy Stearns, though, was really my mentor in the office. He was not only responsible for me getting my foot in the door, but he was so well-liked and respected that I really followed him a great deal. And then I was always amused that Randy and Rick Rolfe were nearly opposite in every way, except they were both thoroughly decent guys. But they were lifestyles, values, and approaches to work, and even on issues, they were just completely different. I mean, Randy was the ultimate organized person, the professional. Rick would show up with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth about 9:30 with a phone message from Bianca Jagger, and but he would get his work done too, and it was excellent work. So, you know, I found that pretty interesting, that within an office where there were very clear organizational, there was still a good bit of diversity. We still find that in our office. I mean, there's dress, you can't wear, you know, dress codes and things, and they try to enforce these things in a spirit of cooperation and not a spirit of intimidation, which a lot of offices, I think, impose.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if you could relate in some detail this experience, this first major experience that you had of going onto the floor and working closely with the senator, supporting him in this voting rights.
Yeah, well, he did it mostly as a courtesy to me, you know, why don't you, as a treat, you know. And I think the senator still enjoys that, of getting young staff who come on and, you know, taking him into the dining room or taking him to the floor where, I must say now, 6 years later, that there's not that same feeling when you walk on the Senate floor. Before, it was kind of, you were in awe and you couldn't believe you were there, and if only mom...